The Pen and Shovel podcast is sponsored by Blue Line. Does your building tell your story and let people know what's important to your organization? The architects and interior designers at Blue Line deliver innovative building solutions that give you room to grow and unleash the potential of your staff. Buildings designed by Blue Line showcase what is best about you. Blue Line, delivering buildings of lasting value.
I'm your host, Randy Seitz, and our guests tonight are Will Sender and Bert Pinnick. Will is a senior designer at Perkins Eastman in Raleigh, North Carolina, and designer of Hearth, a memorial to the enslaved. Bert is chairman of the board of Baskerville and lives in Richmond, Virginia. Baskerville was the architect of record for the memorial, which is located on the campus of William and Mary. The competition to design this memorial was an outgrowth of a larger effort acknowledging William and Mary's enslavement of people through the ages. That project is called the Lemon Project, and I would encourage you to go to William and Mary's website and read up on that. It's a multifaceted, dynamic attempt to rectify wrongs perpetrated against African Americans by William and Mary through action or inaction. Since 2009, the Lemon Project has sponsored classes, research symposia, and other initiatives that explore William and Mary's long history with race and race relations. And in 2015, they formed a committee to work towards building a memorial. That resulted in a competition that was published in 2018. And the jury for that jury review of the submittals began in 2019. And our guest tonight, Will Sender, was selected as the winning entry, and then ultimately ground broke on the construction of the memorial in 2021. So, Will, how did you first become aware of the competition, and what motivated you to submit a design?
Back in 2018, I heard about the competition. I don't exactly remember how I heard about it, but I'm still somewhat connected to the College of William and Mary. And so I heard about it somehow. And at that point, I think it was around August 2018 or September, there was 1 month until the deadline. So I had kind of that deadline that I was working against. But when I heard about this competition, it was just very inspiring that that William and Mary was doing something so tangible and real to honor these people and tell this story. And so I knew that I had to get involved and at least just submit a design and see what happens. But at least, you know, be part of that group of people that are submitting concepts and ideas. I had no idea that I would win the competition, but just to be a part of that and to and kind of be part of that energy, I thought that was just really exciting for me.
How did you arrive at the image of the hearth as the right metaphor and kind of the focal point of your submission?
So in thinking through this competition, I knew that any design competition, especially for a memorial, especially for a memorial that's telling a larger story, you really have to captivate people with that overarching concept, that poetic idea. And then from that, the design kind of evolves and comes out of that. But you have to have that basic idea that people can instantly be captivated by and understand and kind of take on as their own theme. And so it took a while to arrive at this concept. You know, I said I had a month, and it was probably 3 weeks into that before I thought of this idea of a hearth. And the way that the hearth came about was, I had gone through a few concepts that, you know, they had some they had some merit, but I knew I wasn't at that, you know, big idea that could really be something special yet. And so I was doing a lot of research about the history of slavery, institutional slavery, at William & Mary, you know, just trying to learn more about it, because when I was at William & Mary, I knew very little about this history and this story. But also to see if there was something that, that kind of connected all of these stories about the enslaved people. And as I was reading some of this research, I kept coming across these stories about the enslaved people themselves. You know, it would be like a record from someone at the college that would say, this man was sent out into the college woods to chop firewood for December and January. And then this, and then whoever that was, I guess, returned with all this firewood for the fires a month later. Or these people were, you know, preparing the fires and you know, something caught on fire. You know, there are these stories about all of this kind of preparation and fire building, and that a lot of the work of the enslaved people was centered on this theme of a fire. And so that was that one meaning, you know, that could kind of connect us to these enslaved people, this idea of their toil and their daily struggle, you know, keeping all the fireplaces in the Wren building on the historic campus going throughout the whole winter, but also other tasks involved with fire. And so that was that kind of tying us in the present day to their toil and their daily struggle. But also, you know, as I thought of this idea of fire and thinking, you know, of this idea of a hearth, you know, it can mean something where it's the toil and the suffering, but it's also a symbol of kind of welcoming and community gathering and storytelling. And just illumination in general. So that kind of sparked the concept, this kind of idea of a hearth that could have so many meanings, all kind of in one word or one idea.
Right. It's a potent metaphor on a lot of different levels. Yeah. We could spend the whole time talking about process, but I had a question when I visited about how did you decide on the scale of it? Because you got the scale right. I mean, it's just right for the space that it's in.
Yeah, and the scale really is about the same size as the competition entry. So, you know, maybe Bert can talk at some point about, you know, some of the discussions we had during the design development of the memorial. But I knew that it had to be, you know, it had to be monumental. It had to be something that you can look up to, but you can also experience, you know, at the ground level. And so, the scale, you know, was about creating that sense of monumentality, but also something, you know, practically, I wanted people to be able to inhabit it, to be able to like walk inside this hearth. And so that decision, you know, requires to be a certain height as well.
Well, it's comprehensible too, as you approach it. When we were walking around trying to find it, we kind of just turned a corner and there it was, and it just looked right from the get-go. So that's one of the many compelling parts of it. Bert, how did Baskerville become to be the architect of record for the project?
Well, And as you were, William & Mary's a public institution in Virginia, right? So their procurement laws are such that they have to competitively solicit proposals for execution of capital projects.
Yeah, we passed on that one when we saw it on EVA. So,
so that's putting a lot of dry words around a very poetic project. But so the project was advertised, and we've been doing work with the Richmond Slave Truck Mission. We were embarking on some work with the University of Richmond on a similar narrative, I'll put it that way, and thought this is something that we should certainly pursue as a project. And I will say personally, it's very close to me. I just want to, before I forget, because on this idea of scale, Will had this incredibly lovely and beautiful idea of, you know, the expanse of this research, the depth and breadth of who these people are is not finished in understanding, right? The research continues. In fact, the number of names between when we started and when we finished grew by, I don't remember how many, but that this memorial had the opportunity to continue to expand. And so I think that certainly speaks of a certain scale, of needing to be of a certain scale. So anyway, we competed for the work. And I think one of the things that was important to us was to have Will on the team. And you know, traditionally you might think of it as design architect of record. And we thought of it more as there is an art, you know, he kind of shies away from it, but there's an artistic intent here. Right. And I didn't see how you could execute on something like this without having the artists guide your hand. And so that was our goal. And so after conversations back and forth with Will, he agreed to join our team.
Was a consultant engagement.
Yeah. Right. I mean, yeah, as the state viewed it, it's one of your consultants.
Right. Like, sorry to keep jumping back and forth between the poetic and the prosaic.
So that's how we became involved. And so we were awarded project in late 2019. Sorry.
We met, I guess, around June, July 2019.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about, and again, this is probably maybe a little bit more the prosaic side of the process, but Bert, talk a little bit about kind of what goes on during the design process, the interactions with the university. I was impressed with looking at the competition submission and how close it is to what actually got built. And candidly, having worked with state institutions myself, I'm a little surprised that survived as well as
it did. And again, this project, you know, there's no roadmap for this. This isn't an engineering building. It's not a lab building. It's not a classroom building. It's not a dormitory. You know, and there's no, you know, roadmap of what it should cost, how it should be, you know, what the systems should work like and that kind of thing, right? This is kind of uncharted territory in that respect. But again, there is a committee, right, that we answer to. You know, there was a budget that the university would have loved to have met. And for the most part, they did. They were close.
I saw the number 2.5. Was that correct?
Yeah. So I think the budget out of the gate was 2 million, I believe. Mm. And then there are the real world conditions of, you know, the site that was chosen. There's underground vault and that had to be dealt with. So there were some structural sort of approaches to how you span the vault and do all those things, right? And then sort of approvals through not only the building committee and subsequently the president, the board of trustees, and moving through those steps, you know. So, but there was all, I will say, the leadership of the university, you know, was very much engaged in this project. And so it was not a, you know, they were there at the beginning and then, you know, 16 months later, we presented something, right? It was President Rowe in the meetings, you know, members of the Board of Trustees being engaged throughout the process. And the importance of it was never lost on anyone. And so, I say it wasn't a traditional execution of a public procured project.
Yeah, a lot of those, the more, as you referred to, educational buildings, classrooms, buildings, you're engaging with facilities, staff, limited involvement. They try to limit involvement of the faculty and staff. So that's very cool. I have to ask one question about the design. So one of the favorite aspects for my wife and I when we saw it was the way that the memorial interrupts the wall that was there before. Was that in the original competition submission that it would interrupt the wall that way?
Yes. So that was, there's a few things about that. One is the original competition was somewhat open-ended in terms of, it just said that the memorial should be on the historic campus. Now you could argue that certain parts of the campus are historic or not historic, or, you know, where does the, is it within the walls around the Wren building, or is it where the sunken garden is? Is that historic or is that not historic? So part of the competition was choosing a site. This site is kind of previously had been kind of not very occupied for the last 100, 200 years. But it turns out through some of the research that this south yard of the Wren building was actually an area where a lot of the daily activities, daily work of the enslaved people took place. And so that was one reason for locating it in this area. And then I kind of thought about, you know, this wall, this, it's creating this boundary, this barrier. It's separating, you know, the newer parts of campus from this historic precinct. And, you know, how interesting would it be if the memorial itself could break through that wall and kind of start to, you know, physically break down a barrier? But what is that then? What message does that send about other barriers that are, you know, physical or theoretical? And so in the original competition, I called for, I think it was in the elevation and plan views. It just said sliced wall. And it was about, you know, 5 feet away from the memorial on either side. This idea that you could pass around it. And in the competition entry, there was really a front side of the hearth that had a stage and kind of a gathering area. And then the back side would, you know, I hadn't really addressed very, very much.
Is that the side where the landscape terrace is now? I mean, are you referring to the side where the lawn is terraced?
On that side? That was the front.
So that side.
Oh, that's facing, the front. Okay. Yeah.
That was previously the front side.
Okay.
All right. Kind of facing the Wren building, the idea that you're kind of at the Wren building and then you walk to the hearth that you can see from the Wren building. And then, you know, and Bert can talk about some of this process, but as we were going through with the building committee and with feedback from the president and other people, you know, there was this new thought of, well, right now it's this one-sided memorial, but could it be something that transcends the old and the, or not transcends, but integrates the old and the new and kind of bridges that in addition to breaking through the wall, is it something that could be this kind of, it's almost turned into like a portal or a kind of a passageway between the two. But yes, the original competition was about breaking down or slicing this wall. And I think that concept, it was a small part of the competition entry. You'd have to be looking closely at the drawings, but that definitely evolved and it actually became more substantial. And, you know, there's more space to kind of go around the memorial and experience it on both sides. And the memorial also has been kind of rotated in a more dynamic way. So it's not, I think the competition entry, I had it parallel to the wall. And then during all of our discussions and the site studies, and also looking at underground utilities and things, this memorial, it's rotated a bit to kind of have, you know, it's not going to fall along this line. It's going to be something that's different and sets its own kind of path and direction.
Well, if you remember, one of the things that evolved was that there's the Legacy Tribute Garden, which recognizes the first African-American graduates of the university and the residence hall where they lived. And then what was a historic work path for enslaved coming out of the Wren building, you know, as best we understood it. So it was kind of nice that we kind of found this axis that helped orient, give the geometry even that much more meaning. So there is that, as Will sort of, that bridge, right, between looking towards the past, looking towards the future. You know, this is sort of that nexus point. So it worked out really well. And I would say, you know, again, our part of our role is AR is, you know, obviously constructability. I think the original design intent was a mass masonry construction. And I think we sought out several consultants, and we ended up going as far as Rome to try and connect with someone, because it was the geometries were very special and unique, right? And to do this sort of mass masonry, it hadn't been done. But again, sort of, you know, there's a world of a budget, and how do we do that kind of thing. So all of that with Will at the helm was fun.
Yeah, it's a masterful outcome. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the other important partner in this project.
The Pen and Shovel podcast is sponsored by Blue Line. Many organizations struggle with the complexity and risk of a building project. The architects and interior designers at Blue Line will guide you through design and construction, delivering a building that exceeds your expectations and is completed on time and on budget. Buildings designed by Blue Line are not only affordable to construct, but provide lasting value for years to come. As your organization or business grows, Blue Line makes sure your building can grow with you. Visit our website at blueline.team today and sign up for a free 1-hour consultation. Blue Line, delivering buildings of lasting value.
Okay, we're back. So the people that actually do the construction, the building, always have an impact on the outcome. Just a little sidebar, I've had an ongoing discussion with an artist in Richmond about, you know, whether architecture, to what extent is architecture art. I maintain that the number of people that can impact the line from the idea to the execution, either positively or negatively, makes it hard for the architect to fully occupy that position of artist, but that's a whole nother discussion. So, Kellstrom and Lee, which is, if I'm correct, a Richmond-based company, is that correct? Yeah, that's right. Construction firm, obviously would have been selected through a public procurement process and so on. Talk a little bit about What was their attitude and spirit as they approached the project?
Well, I think first, everybody that came to the table recognized the significance and importance of what this was, right? Again, it was not a typical, it was not one of those types of projects. You know, this is a once in a lifetime really sort of effort. So I think Kellstrom and Lee, I think, sort of exhibited that understanding and that kind of commitment early on. And then it was really cool. It was a hand-in-hand sort of partnership. You know, I talked about sort of the challenges of the geometries and how we got to it and how we could, how were we going to build this, right? And I think they were very, very willing to sort of work hand in hand with us to figure that out, you know, as we went through the process. I can't say enough the things we did. I think we did 5 mock-ups, if I can.
Oh, wow.
So they did a couple here in Richmond because they were doing a project on the campus at the University of Richmond. And so they built a couple there. And then we had 2 on site and then another one for the concrete work because the concrete form work was very specific and it was sort of a one and done thing, right? So it wasn't like, oh, well, if we messed up, we can re-pour it. So that was a very interesting day. The day the formwork came off, like, dun-dun-dun.
I don't mean to go negative, but in the whole kind of constellation of people that circle around a project like this, particularly during the construction phase, I mean, was there anybody that didn't buy into the spirit of what they do that just, you know, that just kind of said, no, we're going to kind of enforce this rule, this agenda, this budget cap, this code, this code issue. I mean, you name it, you know,
I mean, there were some things like with the DEB or Department of Engineering Buildings at the state level, which is this sort of code review agency, right? For this kind of stuff. And we were talking about sort of handrails for like a one step into the hearth. And, you know, we did things like the hearth is raised, you know, 8 inches. So it's technically not a step. So although any normal person would, you know, those kinds of goofy things. Yeah. So it wasn't that anyone was really sort of adverse to it. There are a lot of people that made sure we checked boxes a lot.
Yeah.
We checked boxes a lot.
That's a good way to put it. There's always some portion of this process where there's just an element of the absurd in it and so on. So, but you obviously navigated right through those.
Well, and I'll give you, like, you know, there's that, you know, you see the curve of the facades of the hearth, right? And so they approach that thing, you know, sort of with ADA, you know, there's some, you know, detectable warning that's required, right? So what we ended up doing was using crushed brick from the wall that was demolished and a stabilizer to make the warning. So getting that sort of through BB is like, this is acceptable was, you know, it was work.
But that was a cool move because I, again, my wife and I visited at the same time. She goes, why is this stuff here? And I said, well, I bet it's because. So well done. Well done.
It's one of those things I always think about in architecture. There should be, you know, little asterisks everywhere. Like this is why this is this way. But I mean, I think things like that, you know, it's part of how the design evolved, like in making it real. And it also makes it, you know, have those little stories and have that kind of richness and texture. And so I think, you know, things like that are, you know, definitely nothing that I had envisioned in the original concept, but that have kind of, you know, added to the story of the memorial as the design was developed.
Well, that to me is the power of the idea, is that there was something so substantial there that as more and more people spoke into the process, that the essence of that idea held. And so when there were decisions to be made, when there were problems to be solved, when there were opportunities, there's this kind of rich set of understandings that guides that and gets you through the end with something that's, you know, as powerful in its execution as it was in its initial representation. Talk a little bit about the process as it was completed. I mean, I watched some of the videos of the dedication and stuff. That must have been, tell me a little bit about the experience of those events and what are the memories that'll stay with you for a long time on that?
Man, I just, it's still overwhelming. Will, I was down at Clemson talking about something else in reference to this, and just, it still makes me well up a little bit. There's still tears that come as we talk about this, and I'm going to do my best not to do that right here, right now. But I think that just, you know, on that day, on that dedication day, seeing Will, seeing Sean and Jody and Ed, President Rowe, all those folks who have literally put everything into this, it was just a big old just sigh, and it was mostly overwhelming to get to that point. And then to just touch the thing and see these people who had only been represented in a typed page in some way, right, were now sort of engraved and emblazoned in the side of this forevermore, you know. And as I said, for me, you know, it is a little personal because, you know, hey, you remember Jackie DeGeorge?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, all right. We did, I don't know what, second year, third year, we did a project, and Jackie leaned hard into her Armenian heritage. And she talked about the generations of family and this kind of thing.
Sure.
And I just remember, it's like, I don't have that. I don't know that. It's not part of my family. I don't have that kind of legacy. And just to think that part of it in some small way has been recaptured, has been named, just gets me, I'm gonna stop now.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's, Will.
Well, I mean, I think it was very emotional, dedication. I didn't know what to expect. It was my first time actually seeing it, complete.
Oh wow. Okay.
Well, and it's actually not complete yet, because the fire pit, the vessel, is still yet to come. But you know, seeing it, I had been a few months before and kind of peered over the construction wall, and I think they hadn't even started laying the bricks. I think it was just the concrete formwork. So for me, you know, I arrived early morning, and, you know, just walking around, you know, they were still laying some of the brick pavers and putting down sod and things, but it was just, you know, walking around. And one memory is walking around and before the dedication, they had kind of a little rope around everything because they were still, you know, laying some of the pavers and stuff. And we walked up, I was with my wife, and we walked up, and there is a dad and his two kids, and they were standing at the edge of the rope, kind of looking at it. And I guess maybe they live in Williamsburg, but it was clear that they had read about it, and the kids were kind of, you know, pointing out things in the memorial. And I thought, I mean, that is when it kind of all came, like, wow, this is actually real, you know, this thing that we've been thinking about for two plus years, you know, this is real, and people are you know, thinking about it and, you know, like that, I think that has stuck with me. And then of course, I think the most powerful thing of the dedication was when various people from the building committee and from the college community read off the names of the enslaved people, you know, both the names where there's a name, but also the unnamed people. And I mean, that I have videos of that on my phone, and I'll look back at that. And that was just incredibly powerful, hearing those names read, but then also sitting there and, you know, seeing the bricks on the memorial at the same time. And just, I mean, it's hard to describe. It's like everything's coming together and it's raw and it's, you know, hundreds of people just kind of in complete silence, listening to these names and just seeing tears run down people's faces. And that was like an incredible experience that I will never forget.
I can only imagine. And the story goes on. I was just reading in the Sunday Washington Post that one of the oldest African American Baptist churches in Williamsburg, that a graveyard has been discovered and artifacts recovered from that. And it's yet to be written how those stories are going to be memorialized as well too.
Wow.
Will, does this, I mean, whet your appetite for the next competition?
Oh man. You're not the first person to ask that, but I have thought about it. You know, I see competition, design competitions come up all the time. And before this competition, you know, when I was in architecture school, I entered a few competitions here and there, you know, for fun or for, you know, or yeah, to do something with some of the other students, or maybe it was part of a class. I think I did a couple of design competitions in my first few years out of architecture school. But this one, you know, it's one of those things where, yeah, it's hard to think about another memorial because this one is so special and so, you know, so kind of part of, I mean, it's been part of my life for 3 years now. So
yeah.
It's hard to think about, you know, like will another memorial ever kind of stack up to this? It's sure. Like, you know, you think of some of the other, I mean, I work on all sorts of other projects, but it's hard to imagine doing another competition for a memorial that, I mean, unless it had kind of the same story or the same power of this, but I think it would feel kind of secondary to this project. So I don't know. Maybe someday we'll see.
I mean, this is a little bit of a silly question, but I mean, it must have been incredibly hard to pivot back from that to, I mean, I'm sure you enjoy your job and I'm sure you work on meaningful and rewarding projects, but there had to be a little bit of a letdown, you know, with your day job.
Yeah, I think what's been so amazing about this project and you know, and the whole process from the competition through the interview that we went all together with Baskerville and some of the other consultants, and then all the way through the design process with the committee is, and Bert mentioned this before, is that pretty much everyone that has been involved has been very involved, and everyone knows how special it is. Everyone kind of understands the gravity of this project and kind of the subtleties and the poetic nature of it. And then, yeah, to go back to another project where maybe it's with a developer or something and it's just kind of like, okay, we got to get done and we got to do this. I mean, I have been part of definitely some other meaningful projects, but none with the same kind of level of kind of focus and understanding about like the meaning and the kind of richness of that.
Bert, if I recall right, you earlier in your career were involved in the design of an African American museum in Richmond. Is that correct? Yeah. And so,
yeah,
you know, this is kind of another chapter in telling that story. Are there other opportunities and other projects, you know, that are part of this story that you see having an opportunity? I also know that you're very involved in community design, you know, working with neighborhoods to tell their stories and so forth. So what's, I get all of which is to say, what's next for you?
Well, I'd say it's out there already. So we're doing work with the University of Richmond on recognizing a burying ground of African Americans that over generations has been desecrated. We're working down at Emory University in Atlanta and Oxford College on creating memorials both to the enslaved and the Native Americans from whom the land was dispossessed where Emory is. We've just met with Clemson, where have conversations with Washington and Lee. And I think that quite honestly, Randy, the way somebody put it to me, why does it take the death of a Black person to sort of propel these narratives forward, right? So yeah. Since the summer of 2020, since the murder of George Floyd, I think there is, at least for the first time that I've seen, a sustained movement towards completing the narrative around this country in totality, right? And so, Will, I would say that you've tapped on the tail end and have a lot more work to do, because there's a lot more story to tell across the country and beyond. So yeah, a lot of spaces that we're working in. We continue to sort of expand the Richmond Slave Trail here locally. Looking at work at the first landing site at in Hampton at Fort Monroe, right there. So I am incredibly fortunate and grateful to be a part of it, to be able to work in this space at this time. I think I would say it that way. So much so, I've built the studio just that.
fantastic. Oh, I can imagine that the people that want to be part of that studio, there's a good bit of a lot of people driven and maybe even some competition to get to be part of that. So, well, thank you all both very much. We've been talking with Will Sender and Bert Pinnock. Will, Bert, if people want to find out more about your work, your firms, just you individually, where would you point them to?
www.baskerville.com. But I would also say we've been talking a lot about this work and pretty much in the institutions of higher education. And so there's a consortium called basically Universities Studying Slavery. And I think if you go to slavery.virginia.edu/universities studying slavery, you'll find it. And and that'll take you deeper into the things that our various institutions are doing. And it's over 80 members right now across the country. So yeah.
Will?
I guess I don't really have a website, but
you're on LinkedIn. That was my big source. Yeah. Big source of information. So look up Will on LinkedIn. So
yeah, it sounds good.
I want to thank Blue Line for sponsoring this podcast. Our executive producer and theme music composer is Tessa Benich. We are going to put some photos of this up on the website, some photos we took while we were there, and try to get some links up to at least the William & Mary site where they can learn more about it. If you have any comments, suggestions, please email us. If there's anyone you'd like us to have this kind of conversation with, we'd love suggestions. And you can send those to information@penandshovel.org. Thank you all for listening.